long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is Andrew Rice, a contributing editor at New York Magazine, which is one of my favorite news sources, also a former staff writer at The Hill, another one of my favorite news sources. So we're two for two here, and he's finally, the author of the recently published book, The Year That Broke America, which we will be discussing today. Andrew Rice, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I thought that before we got to the year 2000, which of course is the focus of your book, that it might make sense for us to start a little bit before that, in the 1990s, which I think in a lot of ways were sort of an interesting, I don't know, interlude, if you will. I was someone who became politically conscious actually before that in the 80s. And having lived through the 80s and the 2000s and beyond, I felt at least like the 90s were this strange period where the stakes seemed a little lower and maybe things were kind of working out, not quite the end of history exactly, but I wanted to get your take on the weirdness, I guess, in a way, of the 90s before we get to the year that broke America.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the end of history. I mean, sort of Frank Fukuyama kind of has to wear that now for life, is his premature judgment. And but I think that really, you know, that declaration was reflective of a more prevalent attitude at the time. He wasn't an outlier in, you know, thinking that history, or at least the sort of Hegelian idea of history, in which you had these two opposing forces, you know, during the 20th century, it was communism and liberal democracy going against one another in eternal conflict. You know, he wasn't alone in thinking that the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the incredibly, I mean, it's, you know, hard to remember it now, but the sort of the incredibly surprising and optimistic kind of turn of events that just came out of nowhere and ended the Cold War and gave us what appeared at that time to be a kind of unipolar world in which liberal democracy, for all of its flaws and imperfections, liberal democracy seemed to be the dominant form of government that every society was trying to move towards. This was taken as a given that this was kind of the way that history was going to continue to progress. You know, I was thinking about, you know, when you asked this question, I was thinking about last night watching Joe Biden give the State of the Union address. And in my book, I make sort of a reference to the year 2000 State of the Union address, Bill Clinton's last State of the Union address, where he stood on the same podium in the House of Representatives and declared that globalization was the central reality of our time. And he rhapsodized about the revolution that is tearing down barriers and building new networks among nations and individuals and economies and cultures. This idea that, you know, the world was coming together was very much a part of the zeitgeist in the 1990s. I remember, you know, in my own sort of youthful days as a college student in the mid 1990s, getting a Eurail pass and going around Europe with a friend of mine and really just like looking at the map and thinking we could go anywhere. And so we chose to go to Albania because Albania had previously been the absolute most, most hermetically sealed nation in the entire world. So we designed an entire kind of month-long European rail journey with the idea that eventually we would end up in Tirana. So we did end up in Tirana. And suffice it to say, Tirana was, you know, was not in great condition at that time. But I think that the point is that, you know, in the year 2000, you know, the world really was our oyster, and our, I mean, America and young people and really the entire world. Cause I don't think that the idea of this, you know, eternal clash and tension among peoples and civilizations, I think that was a little discredited at the time. People thought that, we were all going to end up coming together.
Yeah. And clearly events of just very recent events suggested that that was overly optimistic, to say the least. But getting back to the year that broke America, you pegged that as the year 2000. Of course, it's a nice round number, right? But it was more than just a presidential election year, right? There were things that made it different, in your view, made it special, made it a real breakpoint, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's sort of two strands that run throughout the entire book, and I'm sure we'll talk about them in greater length in a few minutes. But you know, one strand is the presidential election, which will end up being determined by the smallest margin imaginable, certainly the smallest margin in presidential history. But you know, really, it's such a slim margin that you know anything could have swung it one way or another, and history really could have turned out differently. At the same time, and actually in the same place, Florida, where the recount was going on, you had the 9/11 pilots training at that time. Nobody knew what they had planned, but in fact, they were going to change the world, and I think set America and geopolitics on a different course. So that's kind of the central thesis of the book. But there's also, you know, at the same time, there are all sorts of other things happening in the culture. The seeds of the present day are really being sown during that time period. This is like the advent of reality television. This is the high point, as I pointed out earlier, of you know, American geopolitical dominance. This was a time in which, you know, the U.S. had trillion-dollar surpluses, you know, stretching far into the future, in which politics was considered to be kind of a low stakes game, and that you know the Republicans and Democrats really had sort of converged, you know, in a center position. But meanwhile, all these things were kind of quietly coming into the shape of the future was kind of quietly coming into view. I point out my opening chapter of my book involves the Y2K celebrations, you know, the celebrations of December 31st, 1999, the passage of the world from, you know, one millennium into the next, which was this great moment of historical convergence, you know, really an exemplary moment in sort of the history of globalization that we were talking about before. A lot of people predicted that there was going to be, you know, because of a computer glitch, that there was going to be this sort of that there was going to be this apocalypse as a result of it. This was the so-called Y2K bug. So my opening chapter is really about the celebration of this passage in time to a round number 2000, and the accompanying dread that something terrible is about to happen. Now, I also point out that December 31st, 1999 ended up being historically significant for another reason, which is that December 31st, 1999 was the day that Boris Yeltsin in Russia shockingly announced that he was resigning and handing power to a little known caretaker named Vladimir Putin. So if you read the millennium, the 1/1/2000 front page of the New York Times, you know, it has a giant headline that says 1/1/00 at the top and pictures of people celebrating. And then on the left side of the front page, there's a large story that says Yeltsin resigns. I think now in retrospect, we can say that this was a you know, a historically significant date for more reasons than just simply it was the flip of a couple digits to a round number. In fact, it opened a new geopolitical era.
Absolutely. So when you say it was the year that broke America, in what, obviously that would suggest that America is in fact broken. In what sense do you see America is broken in the 21st century, maybe in ways that it wasn't prior to that?
I mean, I think that the primary way in which I think the book it makes this argument, I think, in a variety of different ways, you know, sort of talking about ways in which the American institutions have broken down. But maybe in the the most significant one is American trust in its political institutions, its institutions of authority, whether it's informational authority from the news media, whether it's the authority of our elected governments, whether it's our belief that our elections are in fact factually correct, that the outcome of these elections is correct, and that the president elected is legitimate. These were all things that were sort of unquestioned in the 20th century for the most part. I mean, there were moments at which the validity of elections were challenged, but for the most part, there was never really a serious doubt that even presidents who were elected very narrowly, like John F. Kennedy in 1960 or Richard Nixon in 1968, a really serious doubt that those individuals were actually elected presidents. This changed in 2000. It never really got fixed. There's, as I point out at the end of the book, you know, Al Gore's supporters never believed that George Bush was legitimately the president. You know, when the next election change in power happened, the Republicans, many of the Republicans never believed that Barack Obama was legitimately elected. They spread a racist lie that he was born in another country. And that the primary person amplifying that racist lie ended up becoming the next president.
Yeah.
and then the Democrats in that election spent a tremendous amount of time during the opening years of the Trump administration trying to demonstrate that Trump couldn't possibly have been fair and square elected, and because people supported his politics, but rather it was actually some kind of secret Russian interference propaganda campaign that had gotten a bunch of people in Wisconsin and Michigan to vote against Hillary Clinton, and then ultimately you see the culmination of this kind of cyclical dynamic occur in 2020, where despite where the stop the steal, and I put that in air quotes, movement ends up ultimately culminating in the sack of the Capitol. You know, all of this, I think, you can trace back to a decline in trust in institutions. And that decline in trust in institutions really begins in a profound way with the 2000 election.
Yeah. And I want to talk more about the 2000 election, but I think that's maybe the one thing that a lot of listeners would immediately think about when they think about 2000. But there's another story that happened that year. And to those of us who lived through it, or were politically conscious, it was a huge deal. And I think probably a lot of folks today aren't really aware of the impact it had then. And the way you sort of weave it through the book in terms of the impact into the future as well, I want to talk a little bit about that. That's, of course, what I'm talking about, the Elian Gonzalez story. And so maybe you could give listeners just kind of a short summary of what that was all about and why it was such a big deal to so many people.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned this, because it's true of Elian Gonzalez, but it's true of all sorts of things that are in this book. You know, we have this term, you know, the memory hole, which is the place where history kind of goes to be forgotten, as in the present day, we're so fixated on our present day politics, it's sometimes even hard to remember what happened 2 years ago rather than 22 yeah. years ago. So I find myself often having to explain things that to younger people, things that happened that seem hard to believe that people don't know about them, because they were such big deals at the time, and were so consequential in different ways. But ultimately, they've just kind of been forgotten, because people certainly don't learn about recent history in the same way that they do about you know, 20th century American history. So Elian Gonzalez was on Thanksgiving Day 1999, which is actually the opening of my of my book, sort of like the, when I constructed the timeline for my book, that was sort of, you know, my writing process. That was sort of the first pin on the board was November 25th, 1999. On Thanksgiving Day, a couple of fishermen, leave their home, on the Intracoastal Waterway, on the east coast of Florida, and go out to go fishing. They sight a piece of debris in the ocean. It's an inner tube, and clinging to that inner tube is a tiny boy, 5 years old, near death. And what had happened was is that his family or his mother had attempted with a group of Cuban refugees to make it to Florida by boat. There was a policy at that time, basically, that if you were a Cuban refugee and you made it to dry land in Florida, you basically wouldn't be deported, that you would be considered a legal American citizen and put on a fast track to citizenship. They had been attracted by that opportunity, as many others were, and as many others did. They had encountered storms at sea, and almost all of them had drowned, with the exception of little Elion. He was brought to shore. It was considered to be a, you know, kind of miracle by the Cuban community, the anti-Castro community in Miami. He was pictured in the newspapers. He was incredibly photogenic, a beautiful young kid, and captured the imagination of a lot of people, including on that Thanksgiving Day, the Attorney General of the United States, Janet Reno, who was from Miami and was actually sitting on her porch reading the same news coverage that the Cubans of Miami did. This becomes significant because ultimately what ends up happening is Elion's father, who was estranged from his mother living back in Cuba, says, hold it. I want my son back. I want to bring him back to live with me in Cuba. I have a good life here. Elion's extended family, the father's relatives in Miami, with whom he had little relationship, basically said he can't make this choice for this child. This child's mother died to secure him freedom. The child will live here in the United States and will be free. And this conflict became a custody battle, a legal battle in the courts in the United States that preoccupied the entire nation and all the cable news networks and everything and the news media of that time. Became this giant preoccupying controversy where the two sides fought vociferously about where the child should end up. Janet Reno, the aforementioned attorney general, who is from Miami herself, intervened personally and spent an inordinate amount of time, her own time, trying to figure out how to broach a solution. They were ultimately unable to broach a negotiated solution. And so in the early morning hours of Holy Saturday, basically a few hours after the end of Good Friday in April of 2000, Janet Reno sent in armed Border Patrol agents into Little Havana to seize the child by force. Luckily, no one was injured. The raid was successful in every way except for as a publicity event. It was, you know, there were photos taken of armed Border Patrol agents armed with weapons in the house, seizing the child by force from the family. This became a huge political controversy. It inflamed the Cuban community in Miami, caused riots and all sorts of civil disobedience, and ultimately culminated in, and here's where this ties into the rest of the year that broke America, ultimately culminated in a huge surge in Republican voter turnout, Cuban-American Republican voter turnout in Miami in 2000 for George W. Bush, who had championed, along with the rest of the Republican Party, the cause of the Miami relatives. And this ended up being one of many factors that could be said to, that determined the election, that swung that election, even though the result was disputed, made the election as narrowly appear to be a narrow victory for George W. Bush.
Yeah, and I think that also that play when you were talking about that, the first thing that popped in my mind, those images are just kind of seared in my memory, certainly, that you mentioned. And it also, I think, connects to what you mentioned earlier about that decline in trust in government. And certainly that inflamed an awful lot of people, as you pointed out. And this is something that we see the consequences of and the growth of even clearly to this day.
I think that's true. And I also think that another thing, it was significant for a second reason, though, which was not just about government, but it was also a very significant event in media history, I would say, in terms of the way that this Elian Gonzalez controversy was covered. This was prior to this time, this is the very beginning of what we now think of as our media culture. At this time, this 24-hour cable news network, internet-driven media culture was a brand new thing. CNN had existed for a decade or two, but MSNBC and Fox News were only established in around 1998. They were a brand new kind of entities at this time, and so the kind of 24-hour news competition that we now think of as the familiar kind of media phenomenon, where some kind of event happens, a whole bunch of TV trucks show up and broadcast 24 hours a day from the site of this. This was a new thing. I mean, they called it Camp Elian. There was basically a whole group of television news networks that just stood outside of this house in Little Havana for months on end and waited for something to happen, broadcast every little kind of twist and turn in the family's struggle. All of the members of the family became sort of what we would now recognize as kind of reality TV stars. I don't think it's any coincidence that reality TV itself was coming into being in the year 2000, this idea that these real life people could be entertainment for the public was something that was happening. And all of this actually, this model, the Elian model that you saw happening in the early parts of 2000, ends up being kind of the same playbook that ends up being used during the 2000 recount in Florida. The very same kind of media coverage, exhaustive media coverage, outrage cycle, the use of sort of what we now recognize as sort of proto social media platforms like the Drudge Report and other now forgotten social media platforms or web publications that would sort of gin up short-term stories and short-term storylines that would preoccupy everybody for a couple of days. This was all something that really started in 2000. It started with Elian. It developed into, evolved into what ended up happening with the recount. And it continued into 9/11. I mean, this idea of what we now think, this crawl of news at the bottom of your cable TV screen, that was something that began in the Florida recount. It was kind of dusted off and used again on 9/11. And then, the news crawl has never really gone away. This idea that we're kind of victims to this endless stream of developing news events that are preoccupying and engrossing, but also, we now call it doom scrolling. Also kind of anxiety producing.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of engrossing for the wrong reasons. That really started to come into being in the year 2000.
I want to switch gears just a little bit here and again, move more into electoral politics, and not with the finalists, I guess you could say the Bush Gore thing, but with a couple of candidates who actually didn't make it to that point, starting with, Donald Trump, because 2000 was the first year that Donald Trump really seriously considered running for president. You talk about that in the book. And how serious was that initial Trump presidential run? And why do you think it ended up not working in 2000, but clearly 16 years later, you know, being very successful?
Well, when I talk about the memory hole, you know, this is another thing that fell down the memory hole. Donald Trump's first serious attempt to run for president came in the year 2000, not in the year 2016, which even Donald Trump himself kind of doesn't acknowledge it anymore. He often boasts that the first time he ever ran for president, he won. No, not really. Actually, along with a lot of other things that Donald Trump says, this does not check out. It was a serious campaign. He attempted to run for the nomination of the Reform Party. The Reform Party was as your listeners probably know, but not a lot of Americans know anymore. The Reform Party was the last kind of serious third party to come along in American presidential politics. It was a vehicle originally for Ross Perot, who ran most successfully in 1992, ran again in 1996. In the year 2000, his party still existed. It was eligible for a sizable amount of federal matching funds, for basically money to run its campaign for president because of Perot's strong performance in the previous two elections. But Perot himself was not interested in running again. So the party was kind of there for the taking. And so there was a moment for a bunch of different opportunists to come along and try to turn it into their vehicle. So the two primary ones that came along were Donald Trump, who basically was the chosen candidate of the most powerful office holder within the Reform Party, Jesse the Body Ventura, was a wrestler who had run successfully for the governorship of Minnesota. A lot of people wanted Jesse the Body Ventura to run for president in 2000 himself, but he declared that it was important for him to serve out his full term as governor of Minnesota. And he then turned to Trump, whom he knew from professional wrestling. They had originally met at a WrestleMania event. And Trump was basically put together a real campaign. He had a campaign manager whose name you may know. His name was Roger Stone. And they printed up Trump campaign buttons. He did campaign events, a lot of them actually in Florida, because that was where Trump was living in the winter, as he does now. He had a kind of what I describe as a rose garden campaign from Mar-a-Lago, but he did actually go out and do some campaigning. But the real difference between yesterday and today was, you know, Trump campaign was considered kind of a joke. He went on Jay Leno, they played Hail to the Chief, and everybody made a big joke out of it. The only person who took Trump seriously at that time was really Trump. His primary opponent for the nomination was an individual your listeners also probably know his name, Pat Buchanan. Buchanan was actually a populist, nativist, somebody who campaigned on the slogan "America First," somebody who was against trade deals, somebody who was against foreign entanglements, and who was for fortifying the southern border wall, you know, with actually fortifying the southern border with a fortified fence. All these things may sound familiar. Yeah. as the Trump political platform. The irony of it is that Trump had no political platform at this time. He attacked Buchanan from the left, called him a Hitler lover, and all sorts of other nasty names. Said his followers were wackos, and basically said no one could ever endorse these sorts of positions. Of course, these ended up being his own political positions 16 years later.
Right.
So that was really the ultimately what ended up happening was, you know, Trump had no platform. He had no ideological platform, but he also had no social media platform. And in an era before Twitter, an era before he could access directly speak to the American public and use his this technology platform to kind of captivate everyone's minds. He's very dependent on the news media to get his message out. And the news media basically all agreed that he was a ridiculous clown and didn't really take him seriously or just kind of played it for laughs. And it became very, you know, very difficult for Trump to actually gain any traction. He dropped out.
Yeah. And suggesting how much our culture changed from 2000 to 2016, certainly. I want to talk about another presidential run that got considerably further that year. One sort of near and dear to my heart, because it's the first time my heart was ever really broken politically. I think a lot of people probably felt that. In fact, I know they did. And I'm talking about the presidential campaign of John McCain, who certainly was became a media darling and actually, you know, came well, reasonably close, I guess you could say, had the whole Straight Talk Express. And so what do you think led to McCain's rise in this year? And then what ended up, in your view, kind of preventing him from overcoming Bush and being the person to run against Gore in 2000?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, McCain, I don't spend a ton of time on the McCain phenomenon in the book, because it's already stuffed with a lot of characters.
But yeah.
In part because the McCain phenomenon, you know, ultimately ended up, you know, being, I do think it is an interesting historical phenomenon that in some ways it is a precursor to two different political politicians, completely ideologically different politicians. But in part, I think the McCain 2000 campaign, you can see echoes of Trump's campaign.
Yes, definitely.
In the idea that, you know, we're going to throw the bums out in Washington. I'm going to be the guy who's going to talk straight to you. You know, the Straight Talk Express. I mean, you know, some of that straight talk, if you go back and actually read some of the things that John McCain was saying, you know, some of it doesn't, some of it would get him canceled today. I have to say, you know, he was very much ran on his authenticity, and was, you know, kind of captured a lot of people's imaginations because he didn't talk like a politician really was supposed to. He also, though, the other side of John McCain that I think is a precursor to something interesting is, you know, he's also a precursor to Obama. I mean, in the sense that what he was able to do was inspire people across political lines and especially independents. Ultimately, Obama ended up becoming an individual who I think it's fair to say was quite demonized by the Republicans and ultimately, you know, it's a little hard to remember now, but you know, 2008 version of Obama was somebody who was able to talk to rural voters. He won in Iowa, even though he was a person of color and didn't fit any of the demographic kind of boxes that you'd imagine being attractive to Iowa voters. You know, he had that era of like a fresh perspective and you know, somebody who could inspire people across political lines. It's the thing that John McCain had in that version of John McCain and the 2000 version of John McCain is that he was somebody that people wanted to vote for. You know, he was somebody that people were excited about voting for. The people who liked him, like you, really liked him. You know, it wasn't that they were voting out of anger, like as they were with Trump, although I guess it's fair to say there are some people who really, really love Trump. But in many cases, you know, Trump voters are not so much enamored of Trump, but really just, you know, kind of want to blow up the whole system, I think. You know, in the case of Joe Biden, you know, or Hillary Clinton for that matter, people of Democrats like them, respect them perhaps. They don't necessarily feel a kind of warm and fuzzy feeling, you know, about them. John McCain had that kind of special glow to him, especially in that year. He was just somebody whose character was so you know, his character, his story as a war hero, as a prisoner of war, was so captivating to so many people across political lines. I think, frankly, you know, John McCain, one of the great counterfactuals is, you know, what would have happened if Al Gore had picked John McCain as his running mate. There were some people who thought that maybe he might do that. There's some people who wanted him to run for the Reform Party nomination. There's some evidence that the McCain seriously considered it, running as a third party candidate that year. You know, he decided to do neither because he thought that he probably had a future in the Republican Party. And of course he did. So, you know, he was the nominee in 2008. So it wasn't like, you know, he made the wrong decision there. But it would have been interesting to see what a kind of third party fusion candidacy in 2000 would have looked like.
So before we get to that presidential election in Florida and the recount and that the other big thread that runs through the book, well, there are a lot. There's so much going on in the book. It's almost, I should say to listeners that we're only just scratching the surface. It's just amazing you mentioned all the characters and things and events. And definitely, I want to emphasize that we're only getting just a tiny bit of the richness in this book. But I wanted to talk about one other thread that runs through this, and this is terrorism, because I think most Americans would say, well, terrorism, that's like a 9/11, so that's, you know, after 2000. But throughout the book, you, I think, pretty clearly make an argument that really the precursor to that, the buildup to that, we could see this happening or not, unfortunately, in 2000. And there's a lot going on here, but could you maybe hit what you see as sort of some of the key developments with that in the year 2000?
Well, you know, I mentioned at the beginning my timeline that, you know, and this is like a literal timeline that I is a giant piece of paper that I tacked to the wall in my office and put, you know, sort of significant dates on post-it notes and kind of spread it out somewhat, you know, somewhat maniacally across my office wall. So people would kind of come up and be like, oh, your book seems very very elaborate here. I got a lot of Homeland jokes. But yeah. You know, on the subject of Homeland, I mean, I think that, you know, the terrorism subplot of the book stretches throughout that year. And it begins on the same day that the Elion subplot does. On that day, Thanksgiving Day, November 25th, 1999, a young man named Zia Jara got on a plane in Germany and flew to Istanbul and ultimately ended up in Afghanistan. And he was the first of four members of a group of devout young Muslims living in Germany, living in Hamburg, that went to Afghanistan to the camps that were operated by Osama bin Laden in that year. I think it's interesting, you know, one of the things that I learned in the course of doing this book is, you know, we tend to view events like 9/11 through this kind of lens of, you know, historic inevitability, and to basically not sort of think about how weird and contingent history actually is. One of the most interesting things I found was that these four young men from Hamburg, apparently sort of show up in Afghanistan. Nobody sent them. They kind of sent themselves. They show up in Afghanistan during Ramadan at the end of 1999 as these millennium celebrations are going on around the world. Al-Qaeda is basically trying to come up with an attack to coincide with the millennium that would kind of, you know, get some attention. Osama bin Laden was really obsessed with branding and with sort of building, you know, his what we would now think of him as you know, as an influencer. You know, he was obviously an evil influencer, but you know, he was very obsessed with these ideas of sort of how do you inspire people. And one of the ways that he inspired people was with these very photogenic attacks. he tried to pull a bunch off around the millennium, you know, through his various affiliate organizations in different places. And the best that they managed to do was to try to get a skiff filled with explosives to blow up next to an American warship in Yemen. But the skiff got stuck in the on the sand on the beach, and the terrorists abandoned it there. Ultimately, the Millennium went off without a hitch, in part because the American CIA and FBI and other organizations really mobilized, recognizing that there was a potential threat that Al-Qaeda wanted to strike. So they were able to head all this off. Meanwhile, you know, Osama bin Laden, very disappointed about this, is introduced to this group of four young men. And he says, you know, I have another plan that I've been wanting to do for a while. And they hadn't thought it was practical, but in, you know, around Halloween of 1999, an Egypt Air pilot leaving from JFK had deliberately crashed his plane into the ocean off of New York, off of Long Island, and this had sort of inspired Osama bin Laden to say, like, oh, maybe we can pull this plane's operation off. So he enlisted these four individuals and said, you know, here's a plan. Doesn't really tell anybody else. Hardly even knows these guys. The four of them, including Mohammed Atta, go back to Germany, and they are essentially the masterminds of the plot. While Osama and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were, you know, sort of instrumental in coming up with the concept, the implementers of it were really the pilots who piloted those four planes on September 11th. I follow them through the year 2000 because after leaving Afghanistan, fairly quickly afterwards, they make a sort of search to figure out where the best place to learn how to fly is. None of them know how to fly, so they figure out that the best place in the entire world to learn how to fly airplanes is Florida, in part because of all the reasons that things that we recognize about Florida, good and bad. You know, great weather, lots of sun, lots of ability to kind of fly year round, and also not too many regulations. It's the sort of place where, you know, one of the people who ran one of the flight schools that they trained at told me, you know, renting a plane is cheaper than renting a jet ski in Florida. So they went and rented Cessnas, learned how to fly, ultimately got their commercial pilot's licenses. But during this whole roughly 18-month period or so between the summer of 2000 and 9/11 itself, they were living in Florida almost constantly, living among us here in the United States, going to Walmart, you know, hanging out with their fellow students, really kind of living their lives like Americans, a little bit, you know, fish out of water, but nonetheless, watching what's going on, among other things, watching the presidential campaign, because the presidential campaign is kind of coming to them in Florida, quite literally in some cases. They were, you know, a couple of them, Mohammed Atta and Amaron al-Shehi, were training for a time in an airport in Sarasota, which happened to be a place where a lot of the campaign rallies were held. So they were actually physically present, it appears. Likely they were physically present for rallies that Bush and Gore had at this airport in Sarasota, were able to kind of watch the Americans skirmish over who their next president was going to be, knowing all the while that they were plotting an event that was going to fundamentally change the nature of that presidency and of American power in general.
So for the final event, I guess, the, if you will, and of course we're in Florida again, and that's a thread that runs all the way through the book, right? The 2000 election, which
I call it the unlikely crucible of the future in the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to know even where to begin. Living through it was just so bizarre because there was so much weirdness around this election. You do a great job going into all the details in the book. And I think that while people know, listeners, I'm sure, know that it was an incredibly close election, some of those details that surround it, just even reading, remembering through your writing, just make me just go, wow. What of all the weirdness and awfulness, what would you say stands out the most to you, and how do you kind of look at it, contextualize it?
Well, this is one of those. So Bush, we haven't really talked about Bush and Gore as characters, but it's kind of interesting because Al Gore, you know, first of all, I think the portrait of George W. Bush in the book will make a lot of readers think again about George W. Bush. In this pre-9/11 period, he was really kind of a very different kind of politician in terms of how he presented himself to the public. Sort of a genial, convivial fellow that wasn't going to shake things up too much. Al Gore, on the other hand, was, you know, stiff, intellectual to a degree that it's a little hard to fathom now that he ever made it as far in politics as he did. You know, he talked about things that were considered, you know, just sort of politically beyond the pale at the time, like phasing out the internal combustion engine, which, you know, frankly, would have been a good idea, but sort of fell by the wayside, obviously, as a result of the election. So I think that one of the things that's interesting about Gore also is that he was interested in all sorts of intellectual ideas. One of them is this idea of chaos theory. Apparently in the midst of the election, this incredibly close election decided by 537 votes, just this incredibly infinitesimally tiny margin in the context of 6 million votes cast in Florida, or, you know, hundreds of millions of votes cast across the United States. Al Gore talked about, you know, chaos theory with his advisors and sort of this idea that, you know, butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon and there's a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico. This idea of, you know, small patterns in the universe having outward ripples that have huge effects on history. I think that this idea of, you know, this idea is sort of very central to my book. This idea that all of these little tiny blips, you know, circumstances, random events that happen, end up having these very consequential effects. You talk about one good example of it is, ironically, what's called the butterfly ballot. Butterfly ballot was this is like another one of those things where anyone who's our age roughly will laugh with immediate recognition. Yeah. Uh-huh. And everyone who's sort of like millennial and younger will stare at you blankly and have no idea what you're talking about. But the butterfly ballot was for those of your listeners who don't know, was basically a paper ballot used in one county in Florida, Palm Beach County, an enormous county in South Florida, and was basically laid out on two facing pages in order to fit all the third party candidates for president onto the ballot. And it was designed in such a way that it was arguably deceptive. At least many Gore voters, elderly Gore voters, later on claim that, you know, mistakenly they had lined up their ballot incorrectly and have voted for the person on line two instead of Al Gore, who was on line three. The candidate on line two, ironically, in a great historical irony, was none other than the aforementioned Pat Buchanan. So many, you know, elderly Jewish Democratic voters in Palm Beach ended up voting inadvertently for the guy that Donald Trump called a Hitler lover. That was, of course, caused a great deal of consternation in Palm Beach at that time. Palm Beach became this, you know, incredibly became the central place in which this recount battle, this battle to get many votes that were discarded, not just the butterfly ballot votes, but also votes that, you know, because of faulty technology and not registered a vote for president. It's complex and we don't have time to get into all of it, but there, for a variety of technical reasons, there were an astonishingly large number of votes that weren't recorded in that year, something like 170,000 in Florida that were invalidated for one reason or another. And many of them were in Palm Beach County. Palm Beach became the kind of like the center of the recount battle. So I say in the book, to go back to the butterfly analogy, the chaos theory, butterfly analogy, butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon and a hurricane, there's a hurricane in Texas, or, butterfly ballot flaps in Palm Beach County and bombs fall in Iraq. It's really amazing the degree to which history might have been different in any number of ways had just a tiny, tiny fraction of these votes, many of which we can presume based on their geographical distribution, many of these invalidated votes ended up being salvaged and counted. And Al Gore had been elected president, history would have been very, very, very different.
Yeah, definitely.
So you as a journalist, of course, you focus on the present in your journalistic work, but you spent, for this book, what you mentioned, you're bored. You spent an awful lot of time going back and taking a look at, two decades, a little more than two decades ago. And so I'm very curious to kind of tie things up here. What sort of perspective that really intensive look back at 2000 gave you, in the sense of what sort of things do you now see that were there in 2000 that became, prominent in 2000, and how they affect politics and culture in the United States in, the year 2022?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest one, that we haven't talked about so far is the rise of populism and the advent of what I kind of call conspiracy theory thinking. There's a character in the book that I kind of follow throughout the book named Chuck Carter, who's an AM talk radio host, who's he was a Y2K a doomsayer, but he also was a doomsayer about a lot of other things, including some things that ended up being right. For instance, pandemics. He warned about Vladimir Putin early on. He was very, very concerned about China and U.S. trade policy and U.S. trade deficits ultimately weakening American manufacturing and what the consequences for that would be within the American electorate. So he was sort of somebody we recognize today as somebody who was a Trump voter, Trumper, but in that time period is kind of considered really far outside the mainstream. He was also a conspiracy theorist. He was somebody that, he thought in a way that it is now very familiar, and at that time was considered very, very marginal in politics. So I think the biggest thing that you look back on is how the advent of the sort of unfiltered media culture, unfiltered social media has really changed things, has changed the way people think, has changed the way information is assimilated into the political culture, has changed the way we all kind of get super preoccupied with one thing and have no attention span for other stuff. And I think that, we see that with important things like, Ukraine is dominating the news right now, but we also see it with, all kinds of trivial matters that really aren't necessary, that come along and really aren't all that important, but ultimately for reasons no one can quite comprehend, end up dominating everyone's conversation and everyone's minds for a little while. So that's really like the major I'd say that's sort of the major difference I noticed between then and now. The thing that was really kind of just starting to come into being then and was likely to really profoundly change the world. I do want to end on one note, though, if we're wrapping up, which is that the other thing that I think is interesting in studying history is that, we've had a kind of little bit of a downbeat conversation in the sense that, and the book, of course, is titled The Year That Broke America, so it's my fault, right? But I think that, one thing that I think that it's important to note is that, things that are broken can also be fixed. Broken doesn't mean that things are broken permanently. I do think that, the fact that we've been there before, the fact that we lived through a time when suddenly in 1989, 1990, 1991, suddenly the world got better for reasons that no one kind of anticipated and that no one really saw coming. All of a sudden, things got better and the economy got better. The world kind of became a much more peaceful place for a little while. It was this little idyllic period. And this book is like a fun book. It's about a time in which the stakes of everything didn't seem so existential. I still have optimism that there's a way that we can somehow get back to a time when it doesn't seem like every presidential election might be the last presidential election. And it doesn't seem as if every foreign policy crisis might be the end of the world, literally. I think that it may be hard for us to see it now because, one of the things that's kind of implicit in this book is it's really hard for you to see it when you're in it. But I think that one of the things that I think is implicit in this book is that even if it's hard to see how the story ends happily, that doesn't mean that we can't work to make it end better.
Amen. Yeah, I'm glad. I always like to end on an optimistic note. I'm glad you were able to bring us around to that. And as I said, it's just a fascinating, fantastic book. I just give it my highest recommendation. So much in there. And Andrew Rice, it's been a pleasure talking with you about it today.
Yeah, this has been really fun, and I'm really glad that you asked me some questions that weren't necessarily that were sort of like about other parts of the year 2000, because there is so much there, even more than is in the book, and I really enjoyed having the conversation.
We hope you enjoyed this Politics Guys interview, and if you did, we'd really appreciate it if you could mention us on social media or however else you share things you like. It would also be great if you could rate and review us on your podcast app. If you got a question, comment, correction, gripe, manifesto, whatever, you want to share it with us, you can reach us a bunch of ways. mail@politicsguys.com, as well as there's our supporters exclusive Discord channel, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to become a supporter of the show, you can find out more about that at patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support. And links to all that are always in our show notes. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new episode this coming weekend. We hope you'll join us.